everyone. Today is May 19th, 2019, and this is episode 181 of At Percussion. With me today is co-host Casey Cangelosi, who I think has never been so relaxed two episodes in a row as co-host. How's it going, Casey?
This is great, though it's a little intense because I'm missing the series finale, Game of Thrones, right now. So I don't know what Ben's excuse is, but that's a big sacrifice.
It's pretty serious.
Good hero to miss the Game of Thrones. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Which a leader always says to the drummer, thank you for your time, right?
Right. Yeah.
So also,
Casey's office, because it's almost as messy as mine. Thank you, Casey. Now I don't feel quite as bad.
But look, these stands are in a little... Oh, it's just two of them. Those two stands are in a line. Look at that.
Yes.
Yeah, and the marimba's up against a wall. Yeah, it's so bad. It's a constant state this way.
That's the way my studio is all the time. It's, yeah. I can never find anything. So there's so much stuff in it.
There are all these studies talking about disorganization and actually how people who are really cluttery are actually really organized.
I'm glad you said that. It makes me feel better.
I just keep reading the same one over and over.
Yes. Yeah.
Very unusually intelligent too, I think. That's what I heard.
They say that too. I just keep reading that same one when I feel terrible about the state.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant and genius. And
I prefer that.
So also joining us today is a very special guest. We have Professor Bob McCormick. Robert McCormick is currently Professor of Music and Director of the Percussion Program at the University of South Florida in Tampa. He served as Principal Percussionist and Assistant Timpanist with the Florida Orchestra for 20 seasons and is a former member of the Harry Partch Ensemble. His many recordings with the McCormick Percussion Group, McCormick Duo, and others are continually well-received, and Bob has been the recipient of many awards, including the 2015 Percussive Arts Society Lifetime Achievement in Education Award. So it's so great to have you on the show, Bob. Welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So I think we were just talking a little bit. Is everybody officially in summer mode?
I think so. I'm just trying to work up the chops again.
It feels like summer for me now. It's been summer for a while, but like went to visit family came to visit, lots of stuff to tidy up around school, and actually, you know, concert on the lawn today, so some logistical things. But yeah, it does. It finally, like, you know, you can tell when your body feels like it is summer.
For me, it's always every semester a slow decline in activity because college is done, but the high school programs are still wrapping up, final concerts. I got one or two more weeks before everybody's done for the summer.
And the orchestra seasons are winding down as well.
Oh, yeah. So, for better or worse. Yeah.
Freelance work starts to dwindle over the summer, at least in Tampa.
Oh, in Miami, too.
Yeah.
Bob, you strike me as somebody who doesn't do nothing over the summer. Is that right?
I stay pretty busy. Again, I don't know about you folks, but I can't practice in the school year very much. So I literally use the summer to try to work on my technique and go back and work on lots of fundamentals and go through some excerpts and so on, so I can at least demonstrate them halfway to the students and things like that.
Is that, you know, I mean, of course, I'm realizing that more and more, too. You know, you find, sorry to totally switch topics here, Carly. You do find that, like, during the school year, it is, of course, harder and harder to get your practice time in. And, man, any advice, younger professors, for us? Is this how it will be? Is there something we can, I don't know, is there a way to get to fight this better?
I don't think there is. You're lucky because you're young. So the chops are going to work easier for you.
I see.
It's just a battle that we all face because we have so many instruments too. And, you know, if you're back there playing triangle for a week, that's a week of a different kind of practice. So that really becomes the practice. So I think there is professional upkeep because you're playing all the time, but it is a little different where you don't have quite the time to work on the fundamentals that we all need.
It's funny you mentioned triangle because I'm literally practicing triangle a lot right now. I'm writing this piece for triangle and tape, which means I have to hold a triangle for a long time. And just this that for so long. Of course, you're writing, so there's a lot of time there. You're practicing, so there's a lot of time there. But just hours of that, like, oh man, it's, yeah, you have a limited amount of time. You can hold a freaking triangle. But, you know, we had John Beck on, many, many episodes ago, John Beck Sr., and this time management thing came up. And we asked him, like, yeah, being a professor so busy, how did you do it? And he said, well, back then, you know, when I was teaching and playing in the Rochester Philharmonic and I was so busy and they asked me to be on a committee, I just said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have time to do that. And that was it. Like, Carly, can we do that? Are we allowed to do that? Can we just say we don't have time?
Once you're past the 10-year mark, you have a little bit of more freedom to say no.
Right.
I've told my chairman many times, I don't have time to be on committees, and some committee comes up and there's nobody else to serve. So you do your duty.
Yeah.
If you want it done right, you end up saying, yes, I'll be on this committee.
Right.
But you're right. You have to minimize your committee work, I think, and to get the time management and leave yourself some time to practice and just think.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, you know, one thing as I'm looking through your resume and reading your bio, like it seems that you've done really well making sure you always have time for projects, projects like all the recordings you're doing and commissioning that you're doing. So I guess segueing into time management, is there some, like, how do you prioritize and how do you manage your time split between so many different projects and not letting just the day-to-day grind of teaching and performing take over your life?
Well, I think it's fear management because you have this project, you say you're going to do it, and then all of a sudden the deadline is coming up, so you know you have to be prepared. So if you're working with composers and you say, well, sure, I'll play your piece, and we'll play it on this date, and so all of a sudden the date is approaching, so you have to make time. So it really is, that's the motivation, I think. You say you're going to do a project and there it is. So it gets done because you have no choice.
But I guess the key that some of us miss is you have to say you're going to do it,
set
a deadline, and then you have to make it happen.
Right.
Well, you know, this does kind of lead to, you got a lot of Facebook questions, by the way, Bob. This may be an episode where I apologize in advance, everyone, if we can't get through all your questions. But this may be one of those episodes. Harry Heyman said, your musical expertise is never in question, as is your unique ability to connect with students. So I'd like to know, what do you do for fun and relaxation during the time you spend away from music, not including family activities?
I start every morning at 7 o'clock out on the jogging track.
Good for you. Jeez.
So I run every morning. And that gives me a lot of energy. I think that's been a key for me. And I bike ride any chance I can too, especially in the summer season. Not long bike rides and not long jogs. I certainly am not a distant runner. You know, it's just maybe a quick 20 minutes around the course or something like that. So those are my times away from family in the studio.
Carly, what about you?
Gosh, that's always a tricky question sometimes for us. No, I do yoga and I go to the gym. I go to bar classes.
Is that like you do yoga then have a beer?
That's the yoga bar. No, B-A-R-R-E.
Oh, got it. No, well, here Laurel does do this thing called yoga beer. She does yoga every Saturday morning and they have a beer. It's at a bar.
I've heard of that. My yoga class is at a gym.
It's like a real yoga.
It's regular yoga.
It's not a bunch of people just want to drink beer.
Well, I always tell my wife before I practice that I'm going to hit the bars. So yeah.
So then she'll never know which one.
Which one.
What about you, Casey? What do you do outside of music and work?
Oh, geez. Mine's so boring. I hang out. I play video games and watch shows and try to convince myself the last season of Game of Thrones is salvageable. It's been pretty bad.
I have to say, I've never watched an episode, but I'm starting to feel bad for people that invested so much time in the show with the way everybody's talking about the last season.
It's pretty true. Yeah, it's kind of a bummer. Hopefully tonight they'll turn it all around. But I think that's it. Yeah, I actually played racquetball for the first time in gosh, a long time. I used to play all the time, but you know, Bob, you mentioned biking every morning. I try to bike to work as much as possible, and most days I can. It's a pretty quick ride. I mean, it's a 10-minute ride or so, but I thought, oh yeah, that'll keep me in shape. No, I played racquetball with my brother, and it was just like the hardest thing in the world. It's just a different, just a completely different exercise, a completely different activity.
We're so lucky because our field is so varied that you don't get bored. Every day it's something new and a different instrument that you can't play, you have to relearn or something like that. So I think percussionists are the luckiest people in that regard, just because there's so much to do.
Yeah.
Of course, we're all working with students and each brings their own personality in, and so it keeps things unpredictable.
Right, right. Well, I think, man, we have so many Facebook questions. I think we could just move right along. Nicholas Remy has a few questions. He, and this is quite a change of topic here, but he asks, what composer has had the biggest impact on your life?
Oh, gee, I could answer that. Even though I'm thought of as a new music person, I absolutely love the orchestral repertoire and the music of the masters. And the first thing I did when school was out, having not touched a marimba, is get out the box sonatas and partitas and the cello suites, and I run them every summer.
Wow.
It's just fun to do. And so certainly, I gave a lesson this morning, and it was a young man's first timpani lesson. I said, oh, you know how to hold the sticks good. And I put a Mozart symphony on and we played the symphony. So certainly that. The McCormick Percussion Group has a number of composers that we work with that are all close friends. Baldinder Sikhan, of course. Daniel Adams is a composer that teaches at Texas Southern University in Houston. And I think he's one of the best composers I know, fairly unknown. So if you're looking for great percussion music, he's one of my favorites. Stuart Saunders-Smith and I have done a lot of recordings together. And there's a composer at the University of Georgia, a young lady, I think she's from Singapore. Her name is Emily Koh. And I just recorded a work of hers with five or six percussionists and string trio. And actually, no, I think it was her piece was a violin and bass and percussion orchestra. So, Then we just recorded a work by David Liptak for piano and percussion. So David is another one that's been a dear friend. And there's a composer that lives in Seoul, Chisun Lee, who's written a number of pieces. And we have a CD coming out of hers, and it's a concerto for tuba, Chinese zhong, and percussion orchestra. So odd combinations that haven't been explored yet. And so those are some of the composers that I think are just really good friends that I'm working with all the time.
Well, you know, this is a good segue. Another Facebook question. This comes from, I believe, a student of Bob's, William Brown, who asks, what makes a new piece of music valuable to you as an artist?
Well, I think it just gets the creative juices going. You know, I think one of the funniest things, too, is you can get a piece and you can say, how am I going to make music out of that? And then you do the piece and you don't want to tell the students, this piece is really pretty bad. And so you work on the piece for a month and you say, wait a minute, that's pretty interesting right there. And then you work on it for a couple more weeks and you say, wow, this is the best piece I ever played. I got to record this piece. So, you know, it's really easy to prejudge, I think, especially for younger players. But that's what kind of gets my creative juices going, is when I get that kind of a piece and I haven't figured out what to do with it. And so we just start rehearsing until we can figure out something and make music out of it.
We do have a question from Pius Chang. He says, I heard you were in this Harry Parch ensemble. Who is Harry Parch? I've never heard of him.
Harry Parch was born around the turn of the century. And when all kinds of crazy things were happening at that time, you had Schoenberg, of course, who developed the rose and so on and created tonality. You had Debussy, who went into Asia and created different tonality. You know, maybe a little bit later, you had the cage and the movement. And then you have Harry Parch, who took all of his original compositions and burned them and came up with a new system of writing music based on microtones. And it was 43 tones within an octave scale based on a natural overtone series. And then he invented all of his own instruments, and he came up with contrabass marimbas that sound lower than the lowest note on a piano, bass marimbas, diamond-shaped marimbas, which allow you to play glisses with absolutely no technique, and various stringed instruments. And it was all tuned off an adopted reed organ that was called the Cromelodeon. And he kind of invented his own system of music theory and his own system of notation to play these kinds of things. So he just was an original.
So what was it like playing in the Harry Partch Ensemble?
Well, Harry had a lot of quotes because he once said, "I am a philosophic music man seduced into carpentry," because he was always building his own instruments. But I was with Harry in Washington State one summer, and he says, "Come on, Bob, get in my boat. We're going to go look for some driftwood so I can make a lounge chair." So he actually enjoyed building things and so on.
So what was he like? What was Harry Partch like? I don't think we've definitely had someone who, gosh, has had, I want to say it was Terry Vermillion. I might be wrong about that, but had access to the Harry Partch. I believe it's in Washington State. The instruments are housed there, right?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I think it was Terry. Jeez. But yeah, we've talked a little about Harry Partch, but really not much. And that's great. I mean, you were there, spent all this time with him. What is this guy like?
Harry's an extremely emotional character, extremely nice, was very good to work with. You know, it's like a mentor and a teacher to me. He would come up and show you what he wanted as to how to play the instrument. If you didn't get the right sound, he'd sit there and work with you until we figured out how to get the right sound out of his instrument. So, it was a wonderful situation for somebody. I think I was 20 years old when I had that job.
And for how long was that?
I did Harry for about a year. I did a couple of the before CDs, the LPs with him, The World of Harry Partch. And then we did his opera, premiered the opera, Delusion of the Fury at UCLA. That probably would have been about 1969, I think. Wow. And Harry's conductor was Danley Mitchell, who was my teacher and recently retired from San Diego State University. Probably retired about 10 years ago. So Danley was one of my first percussion teachers.
Well, for any of our listeners that want to learn more about Harry Partch, I was on harrypartch.com, and you can see photos and descriptions of so many of these instruments that Bob's talking about. I saw the bass marimba, or maybe it's a contrabass marimba, that he calls it marimba eroica, that it's basically four really large bass marimba bars. They're suspended over what's called cave-style resonators. And like Bob said, the range extends lower than the lowest note on the piano. And another one that I saw that looks pretty interesting was the cloud chamber bowls. Bob, do you remember cloud chamber bowls?
I will never forget the cloud chamber bowls. And thank goodness I wasn't playing them. I remember, because they're one of a kind. And I remember one percussionist was dutifully playing them and apparently struck them just a little hard. And one of the cloud chamber bowls exploded. And so everybody's running around. And what are we going to do? How do we replace this chamber bowl? So that was an instrument that you had to be very careful about playing.
And what were they struck with?
They were struck usually with a yarn mallet.
Okay.
And they're glass, right?
They're glass. So you can see it's possible. They were Pyrex bowls, but very difficult to get the right intonation out of them. I was going to say another fun instrument of Partch was the Mazda marimba, which was tuned light bulbs. And the filaments were taken out. And we played them with pencils with big erasers on the top.
Wow, cool. That I've never seen.
And there's a microphone stuck inside the acoustic chamber to bring them to life.
Yeah. What do you got there, Carly?
Well, Bob, I wanted to ask you some questions about the McCormick Percussion Group and all of the recordings that you've done. So I guess we'll get started with such a huge output of great, interesting new music. What were some of the highlights of your projects over the years?
Oh, gee. Just getting a chance to work with a lot of composers and meet a lot of neat people. And you know, for some reason, we haven't documented a lot of our music on CD because it's so new. And so I think it's just so important to document music. And there's so many thousands of composers that no one has heard of that have great ideas. So it's really a wonderful opportunity to, you know, to keep developing as a musician to work on these. And, you know, so many times you're just constantly learning. And, you know, a composer will say, use this mallet. And I'll say to myself, he doesn't know what he's talking about. That mallet's not going to work on that instrument. And unfortunately or fortunately, the composer's right. And so you're constantly learning things and just trying new things, because some composer who was not a percussionist, or maybe was a percussionist, visualized this and came up with this unique sound that happens to work at that moment.
Actually, I have an example of that. When I was a student, we did it at UM. We did, I don't remember what wind ensemble piece by Colgrass, and Colgrass wrote that you should use a bass drum mallet on the marimba. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. That sounds like a silly thing to do. Yeah. And, you know, so Mr. Green stops rehearsal and says, it says bass drum mallet. I was like, okay, I don't think anybody's going to like it, but I'll do it. And it sounded amazing. It was just like no attack, but all the resonance.
Yes. Yeah. Another very interesting example. I had a composer once write for gong mallet in the center of a timpani head.
Cool sound.
It sounded really cool, but think about how heavy a gong mallet is, and it ruined the timpani heads. And so after that, you know, I had to replace all the heads, and I don't know that I would do that again. So if you're asked to use a gong mallet on a timpani head, make sure they're old heads, because they'll be gone.
You often get that composer, though, right? They want you to do something that's, it's like, yeah, this does sound cool, but I'm not going to break my instrument.
I was not in the piece, but I had a composer friend that had written a piece, and I think it had a solo bass part. And the bass player had a rap on his instrument with his knuckle. And the composer says, that's not loud enough. And so he went over to the bass and he rapped it with his knuckle and he broke the guy's bass. And of course, the composer felt terrible, and it was repairable. But again, composers have to learn too. It's a lot of things are not possible. So, you know, it's always a give and take.
Yeah. I don't know if we need new sounds so badly all the time. I feel like, I don't know, it's almost like there's a race to find the next new sound. But with all the electronic use now, new sounds are just everywhere, you know?
Yeah, I think Milton Babbitt once said, there's nothing so boring as a new sound, or something along that way. So unless the new sound is used intelligently and creatively, the new sound's going to wear out very quickly. So, you know, that's why you need the great composer to try to use it in a manner that makes some type of a logical, formal sense, I guess.
Well, I know when I'm trying to write a tape piece, I mean, and I've probably said it on this podcast before, but just getting around picking your sounds, just trying to pick them, because there's just so many.
Sure.
You know, you've got a row of four oscillators this way and a row of this 4x4 quadrant of all these different manipulators, and then a couple hundred pre-created sound banks, and you can manipulate them from there. I mean, I'll spend hours just trying to decide what is the cool new sound, and there's so many new sounds. Yeah. So I don't know. I just my personal feeling, I hope that's kind of done, you know?
Well, every composer has to have something original, or what does it do?
Yeah.
We can't write like Mozart today.
Yeah.
So there has to be a certain amount of exploration. And certainly one of the ways that I found to explore is percussion with other instruments. We've done a number of piano concertos lately, for example. And while there's certainly been a variety of piano concertos before, that there's still a dearth of literature in that area. One of my favorite CDs was the Soli for Soprano and Percussion Orchestra. And we actually went back and did the Jan Baracke Chant après Chant on that CD. But we had several other excellent pieces come in with voice. And I think there's an endless exploration with voice and percussion orchestra, an endless exploration of strings and percussion orchestra. It's one of the CDs that will come out probably in 2020 or 2021 is with a string trio and percussion orchestra. And so those are the kinds of things. They're not necessarily new sounds, but the combination creates a kind of an area that has not been explored a lot, and at least creates an interest for me.
Well, I didn't, this is such a good segue. I didn't plan on doing this early in the show, but I do have a sound for y'all this week. Bob, we often do something where I play a sound, and you know, if you have a guess at what it might be, please go ahead and shoot it to us. But then I kind of explain it. So what I have for you this week is the following.
For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart.
Hey listeners, time out real quick. This is the first of two little editing inserts I have to do for this episode, but you're supposed to be listening to Edgar Varèse's poem Electronique right now. Unfortunately, I was unable to upload the video due to copyright claims. They blocked the whole episode, and they didn't just demonetize it, they blocked it. And so sorry about that. If you want to listen, that's what we're going to be focusing on a little bit. So there's lots of great recordings that are abundant and easy to find. It's Edgar Varèse's poem Electronique. Thanks.
12 o'clock rock, we're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your flat rides on. Join me home.
Okay, so you probably recognized a couple of those pieces, at least one of them. But what do they all have in common is the big question.
I have no guess.
That's good. That's okay. These usually are meant to stump. So, of course, you probably recognize the Varèse piece in there, right, Carly?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Poem Electronique is one of the really famous, arguably the most famous, and one of the most important original compositions for just tape, but everything you heard just in order. So this was a Frank Sinatra song, and of course Billy Haley, Rock Around the Clock, and we're going to talk and focus on Varèse's poem Electronique. But what these three have in common is that they're all recorded with this 1950s Ampex tape recorder machine. Varèse, okay, who we've talked about on the show before because he's composed the, you know, first standalone percussion ensemble ionization. I think Ben reported on that many, many episodes ago. But he also wrote this really famous piece called Poem Electronique. And supposedly in the 50s, Varèse was having some major compositional writer's block, something of a depression, and he was anonymously sent a tape machine, a tape recorder. It could record, edit, and play back, and it was by this company called Ampex. So the first thing you heard was some sounds of fast-forwarding and rewinding and some clicking buttons of 1950s Ampex tape recorder. So this probably wasn't the generation that Varèse was sent. He was probably sent, because we have the date, 1953, he was sent probably a second generation Ampex tape machine, which by then they were a lot cheaper and a little more portable. And this was supposedly the thing that got Varèse out of his compositional block. And then he went on to finally finish his piece called Deserts, and then Poem Electronique, really his last four pieces, which doesn't seem like much, but Varèse's body of works is pretty small. You can listen to the entire collection of Varèse, and I think it's a really short time. I don't know, but it's a very, very short list as far as famous composers go. So yeah, I found this really cool resource that explains all about this tape machine. So it's, you go to www.reel2reeltexas.com. There's this production company and this museum. It's a museum of recorded tape called Phantom Productions, but man, $10, 7 hours of video on the history of recorded tape, and they have all these little labeled segments, and they go through all these different machines, and they have three little segments on the Ampex tape machines. And of course, this is what Verez was sent. So this supposedly lifted his depression in 1953, and along with the studios and other synthesizers he was able to work with, which was really, really hard at that time, he was able to produce the famous Poem Electronique. So Poem Electronique, as a lot of you may know, it was premiered at the 1958 Brussels World Fair at something called the Philips Pavilion. And if we get talking about this a lot more, we'll also talk about Xenakis, because this has a lot to do with Xenakis, as he's one of the architects behind the Philips Pavilion. And if you're watching the show on YouTube, please keep your eyes up, because I'll definitely overlay some things here about the Philips Pavilion. So really, really cool architect building, and 450 speakers, by some accounts, are lined up inside of this building, lining the walls of it. And as the people would walk through in kind of a S shape, they call it the shape of a stomach, is how they describe it, at least the topographical layout. As they go in, they're hearing all these panning effects from the 400 to 450 speakers that Verez and the designers used. Another cool thing about Philips Pavilion and Xenakis claims credit for the design of this building. As you know, he's also an architect, mathematician, composer, and his employer at the time, and the guy who made the film to Poem Electronique, there's a film that goes along with it, this guy's name is Le Corbusier, and he claims credit for the pavilion, but Xenakis has proof, as the story goes, and that is Xenakis's score to the piece Metastasis. So supposedly the curvatures of the pavilion also follow the same glissandi curvatures of Metastasis, which predates the development and production of this whole project. And I guess this building was very, very cleverly designed, because supposedly when the wrecking ball went to tear it down, it's a temporary structure, as was everything at these world fairs, the wrecking ball supposedly bounced off the building, because the building is so structurally sound. And the engineers were telling Xenakis and Le Corbusier that, no, this building is not going to stand the way you have it in the blueprints. We need to add all this extra reinforcement, blah, 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 blah. And they said, no, 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 it's going to hold. It's going to be fine. So not only did it hold, but it was hard to tear down. Another fun fact about that 1958 Brussels World Fair is there was a page of the Mozart Requiem, speaking of Mozart, on display, and someone tore a page off of it in its display, so vandalized the Mozart Requiem, and we still don't know who it is. We still have that page with the tear, but it was at that fair that we've got Xenakis and Verez, who of course is, you know, Verez is always talking about new sound, it must be new sound, and composition, I need to be free from the old tradition of classical composition. So I bet it was Verez, it seems like it. Probably not, but
you heard it here first.
Yeah, so pretty cool. A few other things about this Ampex machine. The Ampex developers had successfully demonstrated this tape recorder back in, gosh, I want to say 1947, I believe this is, and it was very successful. People were very impressed not only with its ability to record and play back very accurately, but especially its ability to edit. And Bing Crosby, the very famous Bing Crosby, sent the Ampex company a no strings attached $50,000 check in the mail to develop and produce these machines, because he was so invested in their development. And it wouldn't have happened without that. They did not have the money to produce more machines. They had the one that they demoed for everyone. And this was called the Model 200A, and it was developed, yes, in 1947, I was correct. And it cost $76,000 to develop, which in today's dollars is right about $870,926. So a little under $1 million to just develop The following year, they would be sold for $7,500, which is like $85,900 today, and a little later, $5,200, which is about $60,000 today. So Bing Crosby might be why Verez got out of his funk, because they wouldn't have developed those machines in 1947 for them to be out in the public for someone to anonymously send it to Verez in 1953. And that's about the end. That's all I've got.
That certainly is the pioneering of the electronic tape and kind of precedes what James Tenney did at the Columbia University. And I think Davidovsky took that over and wrote one of our masterpieces, the Synchronisms number 5.
Mm.
That would have been in 1965, I think. But truly one of the masterpieces of percussion ensemble writing is the Davidovsky Synchronisms 5.
It's funny piece. I mean, I've listened to Poem Electronique a couple of times, but there's been very few times I can really sit through it, I'm going to be honest. It's 1957 to 58. It's a tough one to crack. And I like Verez, generally speaking. I especially like Hyperprisms. That's my favorite piece of his. And I really like Ionization. But yeah. Man, Poem Electronique is a tough one to listen to for me.
I love Integral and love Equatorial. Mm-hmm. And we've done both of those as part of percussion concerts, even though they're involved winds and you got to have some good brass players to pull those off. But two really very precious pieces from that period. And those are non-electronic.
Right. Yeah, he I think it says early, it's before 1920, I believe it's something like 1919. Verez is already talking about we have to liberate ourselves from the sounds that are available. Our instruments need to be better. Again, speaking of Harry Partch, our instruments need to be more interesting. And also we need to have a way to have our creations immediately played back. And as soon as recording and electronic stuff was beginning to happen, this is before he had his actual tape machine, he was saying, I believe in the near future, we'll have machines that will be able to play back exactly what we write and perfectly, and a composer will be able to hear exactly what they wrote.
If I remember my music history books, he mentioned something about we must have a new alphabet or something, or was one of the Verez quotes. I'm not saying it exactly, but certainly. Yeah. That was among those early quotes of Perez.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, our instruments need to change. Our instruments need to be better. It is something along those lines.
Yeah, it seems like that whole time period was just, let's look for what's next. You know, is it electronic sounds? Is it recording? Is it new instruments, different instruments? You know, and with Xenakis was combining elements of architecture and visual elements to musical, and Mauricio Coggle was doing similar things in, of course, different ways, but there's just a lot going on.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. Like, I wonder if that's over. You know, flash forward or flashback 20 minutes ago, we were talking about new sounds and like this compositional race to find the next new sound, and hitting a timpani with a gong mallet, ruining the head, and breaking your friend's bass bridge with, you know, the experiment of knuckles over the bridge. And yeah, I don't know. It's there's just so many new sounds. They're just not hard to come by anymore. You know, you're on the internet. You're just tripping over new things. And yeah, I don't know. I kind of wonder if that's like not what people are craving anymore. And of course, we're trained to think this way. You know, the history book, we only demonstrate the people who show us new things. Like, well, you're in the history book because you did something new. So what is the natural course of action? Well, you got to do something new, you know?
Well, I think you're exactly right. And it's not the new sound as much as how the sound is used in creating a thoughtful sentence that makes it interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think this, and I really hope that's what it's doing, because I think there's so much more to good stuff than, ooh, that's a sound I've never heard before. It's like, come on, man, we hear sounds we've never heard before like all the time, you know, like just in life, you know, that's not that unusual. Carly, how about another Facebook question, and then we should probably talk about this marimba festival.
Sure. Yeah, I have a good one. This is from Yunmi Ko, who I think is one of the composers you've worked with, Bob. And she says, this is a question for the legendary MPG director, Bob McCormick. Do you ever get angry? And how do you keep cool all the time during rehearsals?
I want to see him angry.
Well, Yunmi Ko is, I think, the best new music pianist and one of the best musicians I've ever worked with. And she's starting a new music festival in Korea called Dot the Line. So that's where she is right now. But she's done a number of the recordings with us. And I don't know. If I lose my temper, I'm usually acting because you're working with students and they're doing the best they can do. So there's no reason to lose your temper. You know, you just have to create things. So I hope I don't lose my cool. It just is counterproductive, in my opinion. You know, the days of the old conductors doing that is fortunately over, I think. And I think that was counterproductive, and that's been proven.
Charlie, do you ever lose your cool?
Well, yes. Sometimes I try not to. You know, sometimes I think you have to a little bit, or at least like Bob said, like as an act, because sometimes students need to know where is the line and, oh, I just crossed the line and that's what happens. You know, it's not in my nature at all to quote unquote lose my cool, especially with students. But I think it's a balancing act. Sometimes people need to hear those things.
Yeah, it seems like the thing is you maybe get a little angry, but you don't actually lose your cool. They're so used to you this one way that even if you just turn it up a little bit, it's like, whoa, they're really
right.
that's been useful. But if they actually really knew you, it's like, no, this isn't even close to me losing my cool. Yeah, so that's
and
that's,
you know, if a student's not playing well, peer pressure today, because all the kids, you know, they help each other out. And they say, oh, so-and-so, we've got to make sure they're here practicing and so on. So
yeah.
Studios, I think percussion studios are so close that they kind of take care of each other. And I love seeing that when it happens in the studio.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I love that about the students here. They just, you know, really, really, they're fine. Letting me down is so much easier than letting each other down. That's for sure. Yeah, that's really, really valuable. Question from our friend Brian Nosny. He says, what pieces do you feel are the most important staples of the flute and percussion repertoire?
Oh, let's see. There's again, a number there. The first thing that popped into my mind was the Ingolf Dahl Duettino Concertino. And Vic Firth premiered that probably in the 60s. And that's a favorite of mine. I'm trying to think of, there is a serial composer that wrote an opera that was played at the Met a couple of years ago that wrote a marimba flute piece. And Hugo Weisskopf, that is a really interesting piece if you're into serialistic kinds of compositions. And I think one of the more fascinating pieces that is rarely played. Ralph Shapey's vibe and flute piece is certainly a favorite of mine that's published by Smith Publications. Dan Adams wrote a piece called The Twilight Remembered that was one of my favorites. He wrote that as a wedding gift for my wife and I. And we kept it in the library and played it several different times.
Very cool. Very cool. Carly, what do you got there? Something about Marimba Fest, I think.
Yeah, Bob, I wanted to make sure we talk a bit about the McCormick Marimba Festival because it's just such a great weekend packed full of performances. And in fact, that was the last time I saw you, I think, was this past January at the festival. So would you tell us a little bit about how did the McCormick Marimba Festival come to be and maybe some of the challenges that have come up in hosting such a festival?
Well, it's really a lot of fun, and it certainly started out, I think the first year was 2002 or so. And I just needed to get more mallet players in the studio. So the first year was open to high schools. And then the second year, I think my colleague Jeff Moore at UCF said, well, we'd like to come over. And I said, that would be fantastic. And so after that, I started it opening up to universities. And then more and more universities wanted to do it. And then it just came up. And it's really easy. If you think of Marimba Festival in January, somebody up in Canada or Massachusetts is more than happy to come down. Instead of 70 below, it's 70 above. So right. I think that's been one of the real fun things about it is that kids get away. And it's never been competitive. And I'm really thankful about that. And as when people, they do their own selections, and if two people select the piece, we kind of all agree, well, we're going to learn from you, and you're going to learn from our performance. We're going to learn from your performance. So it's just been really in the spirit of learning and hearing different things. And of course, it gives me a chance to hear all the Marimba literature that people are playing around the country and decide what I like and what I like to do with my kids. So that's the selfish reason.
And I know JMU was there probably 6 years ago.
About 6 years ago, yes.
Yeah. Do you know if Bill Rice brought all his own instruments?
We let everybody use our instruments.
Oh, okay, okay. He's got these amazing marimba cases here that are just ridiculously humongous. I figured, oh, well, that's, yeah, he probably uses those every chance he gets, but maybe that fizzled after a while.
And of course, Bill Rice is in Florida now and lives close to us. So we hope to get JMU back soon.
Yes, yes. I actually was cleaning out email and I saw a notice about your...
I was wondering, so.
Okay. I saw it just recently, but man, yes, it's, yeah. Well, and I was there, God, I was there, I don't even know how many years ago, probably similar, about 6 years ago also, before I was at JMU. But yeah, just, yeah, Carly couldn't have said it better. Just what a wonderful thing you've created.
But we try to bring in different ensembles every year and always try to invite a couple Florida ensembles and bring the rest in from out of state.
Can you talk a little about, I know friends of mine who've maybe started a new summer seminar, summer festival, and they, you know, they often say, okay, that was great, but that's, I'm never doing that again. And then they end up doing it again. And then they say, oh, I'm never doing that again. It's so hard. And they, you often hear that. And I don't know, just any advice for how to make this easy on yourself. I mean, obviously you get better at it every time you do it. You probably learn some new lessons, but anything to encourage how to keep going with that and not get burnt out on all the organizing and how difficult that must be.
Well, it does take some time to organize, and I do a little bit almost 365 days a year. I'm writing to somebody or answering a question about it, and so it doesn't all group up on me in one particular day. Sometimes I'm lucky and I get a good TA and they take care of the program for me. Mm-hmm. And so it's not too bad because it's only a 2-day festival. And okay. We pay very little or not at all because everybody wants to play. And so it's more of a fun thing. So one of the headaches that I don't have to worry about is financing the festival or worrying if the budget's going to come out in the black and so on.
Yeah, sure.
The school lets me have the hall for free. And, you know, I may pay some hotels and so on for a soloist and guest and so on. But I don't have to worry up too much about going over budget on this because it's more of a festival of the students.
Mm. Well, one thing that I like about it so much is you get to see live performances of so many different types of repertoire. Like there was just so much, and it's so great. You know, we can all look up all of this repertoire and students can check everything on YouTube, but it's so different when you just see it live and you hear it and you hear everything. So thanks for continuing to do it. I'm glad you're still doing it. I think it's wonderful for students and it's wonderful for us, you know, just to hear so much and of course meeting people and, you know, like you said, everybody's so supportive at the festival.
Yeah, it's really been a fun time.
So, Bob, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to make sure if you could talk a little bit about your experience working with Anthony Cerrone in the 70s. And then we also, part two is a Facebook question from the famous Neil Grover, who asks, can you talk a little bit about your superlative snare drum technique and the influence of Forrest Clark? So it's a two-part question.
Okay. I have been extremely lucky in my life to have great teachers, and certainly nobody was more influential or a better mentor than Tony Cerrone. And one of the best Tony Cerrone stories is I was on tour with an orchestra out of Mexico City, and we were playing in Buenos Aires, and a couple of percussionists from the symphony down in Buenos Aires said, oh, come on out. We're going to have a few beers and some steaks. We'll treat you to some Argentine steaks. So we get out and he looks at me, and I was playing cymbals on Mahler 1. And he says, oh, I think you must have studied with Morris Lang in the New York Phil. And I said, no, I studied with Tony Cerrone. And the percussionist in Argentina says, well, I've never heard of him. And I said, well, I'm surprised he's very famous in the States. Well, we went on and we had a few of those great Argentine beers. And finally, the Argentine percussionist says, well, we use this great book down here. It's by Antonin Scirona. I said, oh, that's my teacher, Tony Cerrone. So once the language was straightened out, everybody knows who Tony is. And he's just, you know, was an extremely kind and wonderful mentor. And it was just great to work with him.
We had him on, you know, he's way back on. Oh, gosh, many episodes ago, probably 100 episodes ago or something.
Look at that one.
It was cool. You know, of course, we talked a lot about his background, but he told us so much current information about the orchestra strikes. I think it was at the time Philadelphia Orchestra was undergoing a strike. And I guess right now, Chicago just finished their strike, but yeah, just all this new information I did not know, you know, just, oh, well, you know, guys, there's a striking is a regular part of like the ebb and flow of orchestra contracting, and just went on to explain so much good stuff that he's great.
Yeah, he's really a Renaissance man with all the compositions and the pedagogy work and the teaching and the career in San Francisco with the symphony.
Yeah, yeah. Carly, does Ben have some questions there?
Ben does. Here it is. So our other co-host, Ben Charles, couldn't make it today to record with us, but he has a message for you and a couple of questions. He says, hi, Bob. Sorry to miss you today. It was a pleasure to meet you and perform at the McCormick Marimba Festival with Carly in 2015. One of my favorite percussion ensemble pieces is Zach Browning's Prophet Beater, and I often referenced your recording when working on this piece. This leads me to two questions. The first is, could you tell us about your experience with preparing Prophet Beater for performance and recording? And did you work with Zach at all? Any interesting stories or anecdotes, particularly in dealing with the rapidly changing meters in this piece?
Really great questions. And yes, Zach was here. And we do everything we can to bring the composer in for a couple rehearsals. And we try to get the composers to supervise all the recording sessions, to be at the recording studio as well. And Zach spends a lot of time down here. At that time, we had a festival called the Bonk New Music Festival, and he was a core composer with Bonk. So that's where I was introduced to him. So it was a natural to get him to write the flute percussion ensemble piece. And, you know, when you have multiple meters, you just slow them down till you get them and then speed them up to the tempo you like. And I think I was really lucky in that I had a very solid drum set player on that recording. So a guy named Chris Bowen was the drum set player and probably kept us all, because I was all over the place with the hands trying to keep it going for sure. You mentioned some things, a question about Neil Grover too.
Yeah. Going back to the Neil Grover question, he was asking, well, his question was, can you talk a little about your superlative snare drum technique and the influence of Forrest Clark?
Oh, Forrest Clark was a percussionist in the Los Angeles Philharmonic that worked a lot with Maurice Spivak. And I would go in to a lesson with Forrest, and I thought I had pretty good hands at that time. And Forrest would give me an hour-and-a-half lesson, and we may not get through the first five or six on stick control. And he was just very, very meticulous with his hands and where you placed each finger and how much elbow you used, how much wrist and arm and finger that you use. So he was one of those kind of teachers. And I didn't work a great deal on excerpts with Forrest. It was really almost all snare drum technique. And so it was perfect for me after I graduated. Forrest was a teacher at Cal State Los Angeles, where I finished my undergrad degree. And then I went with Cerrone for my master's degree. And Tony was really all about the music. And so the two kind of complemented. And I wish I had half the technique, Neil, that I once had. So I can't talk about superlative technique anymore.
Well, here's Bob. Here's Ben's second question. It is, you are an outstanding advocate for new repertoire. Was there any inspiration for this, perhaps a teacher or a performer? And what about a new work inspires you to program it? And how do you manage to stay on the cutting edge of repertoire?
Well, certainly, probably my first influence in new music was Harry Parch. And when I was studying with Cerrone, Lou Harrison was on the faculty there. So Cerrone was always bringing Lou in, and we were playing a number of pieces there. So I think those were my formative years in the early 20s and late teens. And that's probably why I got hooked on new music. And it's the composers that keep us fresh. So, you know, you're just constantly working with new people, and they're coming up with ideas that you have to interpret.
It's partly part of a percussionist's kind of being, right? I mean, because I know other instrumentalists, and I guess I do know of some percussionists who they're not interested in doing new works. They're not interested in breaking new ground. They're just kind of interested in doing what they know. And, you know, why should I play a new violin concerto when I already know these other ones and we know people like them? And yeah, what's the point, you know?
Well, I think that's true. Almost everybody is doing new music in the percussion field today. It's just
right.
That lends itself to exploration.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Bob, a listener named Michael Karp asked two questions. I think one serious and one less serious. The first one is, who is your favorite student ever?
I bet it's him. Just tell it the tone.
The second question is, how do you see the university teacher's role in guiding each student as they develop their own personal taste of music in the art, but also encouraging them to play through significant repertoire pieces? At what point can students stop with the rep game to work on more individualized projects?
Oh, interesting.
Well, it's an excellent question. And I think the first part is every student is different. And you kind of have to let them go their own way. Maybe at a conservatory where there is a stated goal to become an orchestral musician, it would be different. But certainly at us at a university, not every one of my students likes new music. Some of them want to go into the orchestra. All of them have to know some orchestral literature before they go on. In my own philosophy, I'm quite structured with the freshman, a little less structured with the sophomore. And by the time they're a junior, what do they want to study? Where do they want to take their career?
There's a question, I guess, you know, Carly or Bob, it'd be great to hear your thoughts. How do you answer that old question of, hey, I don't want to audition for orchestras. Why do I have to learn orchestral rep?
Well, sure. And it's because it's great literature. And our job as teachers is to get students to appreciate great literature. And the reason they would not want to is perhaps a vocabulary that they don't know yet. So
right. My
job, if a student comes in and says, I don't like opera, it's my job to convince that student that opera is the greatest thing on earth.
Right. That's cool. That's good. I like the vocabulary. I think I go with the vocabulary bit a lot. It's like, well, this is a common vocabulary that we share.
Yeah.
And of course, it's going to relate to whatever other style you want to play, just like how you want to get a classical musician to play a little drum set too. It's like,
Yeah. It's
going to help you with that. Obviously, we know that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's part of how we express ourselves on that instrument. It's part of that instrument's story. That's Yeah. What I think.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think one more question. It's also Nicholas Remy. It's his third question, but he says, what shifts do you think contemporary classical music or music in general would take in the next decade? Would this be a positive or negative in your opinion?
Well, every generation that comes up is creative. So I would have to say it's completely positive.
Mm.
I think economically, we can worry about our students and what are they going to do? And I can answer this question in a couple of ways. I have a number of students that want to major in performance. I think that music ed degree gives them maybe a better chance of working. Mm-hmm. However, this is my 45th year of teaching here, and there's never been a student that has majored in performance that has come back to me and said, Bob, why did you let me get the music performance degree?
Right.
So even if they end up not going into music performance, they seem to be very happy to have gotten that degree.
So, you know, we talk about this
satisfaction.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. Even if they didn't win that spot in the major orchestra or the major gig there. Yeah, it was worthwhile. How do you know, we talk about these worries all the time, like the financial concern. What do you like? Do you think this is going to get better? Is this only getting worse and worse? Is there, I don't know, any wisdom you have from your perspective on it over the years that we can help?
I don't know. Well, if I knew the answer to that question, it would be something. We're turning out so many great players. And so I'm glad that I don't have to compete with the younger generation in that regard. And I think every older percussionist would tell you that today. We're lucky to have our jobs. And there are more players and perhaps fewer jobs. We all know that. So what has that caused? The standards at high schools today is just out of control. It's so good. And, you know, today high school kids do things that when I was a graduate student, I would have struggled with.
Right.
It's just unbelievable. So the standards are getting higher from high school on up. And some of the teachers that may have been teaching at universities in my generation have to teach high school now. And fortunately, there are percussion specialists in high school, so they have really a good job, and they can be very creative people in that atmosphere, play in their local orchestras, and work around town. Certainly, the drum corps industry and the winter guard industry has created a whole bunch of new opportunities for percussionists to be employed that did not exist a few years ago. So, it's certainly something that everybody young needs to think about, is how are they going to make a living in this business?
It seems like people approach it. I kind of see two solutions. We have people advocating for more change, like, hey, let's drop the old curriculum, start teaching like more technology things, different styles of music that are going to get people more employed, get our students more employed. And then there's the other side saying, no, classical music's dying. We can't. This is the last place where it's like we're still advocating it. We can't lose any ground on it. It's already suffering out there in the real world. We can't change up, or we'll lose what little left we have. What little we have left.
Of course, the pop music world is at least as competitive as the classical music world. And I had a student move to Los Angeles several years ago, and he was a very fine drum set player. And he called me up, and he was frustrated one day. Bob, there's so many drum set players out here that the good ones can't get discovered.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very competitive world. Everybody likes music.
Yeah. Well, I know I've brought that argument up. It's like, well, I don't know if studying pop music at the university level is a solution to this. Cause like you said, it is just as competitive. In fact, it might arguably be more competitive because there's so much more of it out there. And it's just amazing bands who you see their CDs and you see their tour dates, and you know, you talk to some of these performers and you find out, oh yeah, no, we're packing up our gear and we're getting in a van. And if we don't make this much money at the next show, we're done. Our tour is over. So like, really? You guys are really, you think, wait, you're like really famous. I've thought you were famous for the last 15 years of my life, you know? And then they are really famous, but it's just, it's hard to make enough money. To keep going.
It's a tough business.
It is.
Well, anyway, Carly, let's end on a downer.
Yeah, right. Wow, it got dark really fast. Well, I was going to say, Casey, I'm glad that a lot of programs are focusing on technology and business and other aspects of music. And there are still programs that are, let's bring classical music and everything to the, just the next level, and let's not let it die.
Yeah.
That way there's more, I think, more space for all of us, more of us and more varied art forms. So I think that part at least is a good thing.
I think that's a great thing. And, you know, we're all successful because we're all a little bit different. And we all emphasize something just a little bit different. And certainly we have to have technology today, and that's there. Nobody's going to change it. And it's like the student who may not like Schoenberg. Schoenberg's there. You can't change it. He was a great composer. If you don't like him, that's, you're the only one that's losing out because you don't like him. So it's all there. You better accept it all.
Well, on that note, Bob, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing so much of your knowledge and experiences. It's really great to chat with you, and hopefully we'll talk or see each other in person soon. And I wanted to say thank you to all the listeners too, that asked questions. We had, at least in the last 10 episodes, it was a record number of questions. So that was great. Thanks for your contributions.
Yes. Thank you all so much for giving me this opportunity too.
Yeah, great to see you, Bob.
Great to see you all.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.